The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, that's great to be with you. And just regarding the cold, the man flu, as it's been derisively called. I don't want any sympathy because it's one of those sicknesses where all the sickness is on the surface. So I'm no sicker than it sounds, and I'm not quite as sick as I sound. Where I know other people live with enduring sicknesses, like people who work with Peter and things like that. And they never complain. I don't think I've ever put, you know, anything like that up on the screen. I just found it such a wonderfully condensed thing, a serious academic study by these two professors from Cambridge University Press, which always has a certain level of control on what they publish, showing that the most influential man was Jesus. There have been other books. There's a famous one put out by an American soldier, which Muslims like because it suggests Muhammad is, and the reason he says it's not Jesus is because a particular peculiar view he has. I like to tell my Islamic friends, don't forget, this is the guy who thinks that America should be split in two, half the states for blacks and half the states for whites. So he's an unusual man, and he's not a historian, the guy who wrote it. These men, on the other hand, are. But there is something intriguing, is there? Not just that people in the first century said, this guy is going to become big, but that 700 years before that, there was this tremendous statement in the Old Testament saying that a man from Galilee will become the world leader. And whether you're an atheist or an agnostic or whatever, it's the sort of thing that any honest person's got to go, boy, that really is, that's a fascinating coincidence. Because all the serious statistical work is quite clear that Christianity is by far the world's largest religion. There's a lot of fear some people have, and some people use it for propaganda to suggest, no, it's not. It's around about 2.1 billion. Islam is about 1.1 billion. Hinduism is about 800 million. Don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting for a second that proves truth. Truth is never worked out by a poll. But it's just interesting to notice. And I sometimes find myself speaking with friends who aren't Christians about the Jesus virus. And people who you can see who have caught the virus of Jesus. There's two ways in which we could talk about that. The way I normally think of it is with people like Catherine and Reg Hamlin, who have now become famous, partly because Oprah and other people have picked up and actually taken over, sadly, the hospital which they set up. These are a couple of missionaries who are quite explicit in their interviews. I loved watching an ABC one where Catherine Hamlin spoke about Jesus as the motivating force, and the next question, rather than exploring, that was a completely other topic. It was kind of, oops, you know, we'll just ignore that. But you see people who do these acts of extreme love, not where they give some money or give some time to go across to the third world and serve, but like these people did, bury themselves in Ethiopia, stay in Addis Ababa during a civil war, there were shells going through the buildings and things like that, to care for the poorest of the poor and the most despised people in Ethiopia. Then a year or two ago, Irene Gleeson died, and only when these people die do anyone outside of their friends get to know about them. She sold a house on the northern beaches, and took all the money to go and buy a caravan and some other stuff to live in North Uganda, which is where the Lord's Resistance Army, which is in no way Christian, but the LRA were doing their terrible slaughtering. You had thousands of children were already orphans because of AIDS. And Irene Gleeson went, moved by Jesus, to go and set up a caravan under a tree. And in the last 20 years or so before her death, she has educated and fed thousands of children. And she's as they've grown older, she's added new educational programs. It's a sort of extreme thing. And as I began to read about her in the paper when she died, I kind of said, this woman has to be a Christian. Again, some of our media didn't let us know that, because they don't like that. If she'd been a child abuser, we would have known. But there's this sort of infection. There's just some people, when you hear what they're doing, and I place a bet inside myself, I'll bet that person's been infected by the Jesus virus. All sorts of other people do kind things. Don't mishear me. I'm not saying they do. Human beings do lots of kind things. We're a very noble species as well as being horrible. But this sort of thing where you don't just be a bit generous, but you endanger your wealth, you endanger your welfare in order to love people that you've actually got no historic, no DNA link with. A bit like Mother Teresa, who goes from Romania to India. So she's not just helping her own people. And this is what I think of the Jesus virus that people catch. But the other way in which you can think of the Jesus virus is the way in which this thing spreads. We've had other discussions here in last year about the way in which Christianity spread and the numbers and etc. But it is quite extraordinary the way in which Christianity has survived in the first few hundred years. Then without picking up a single sword or any acts of violence, all of its martyrs, sadly the word martyr is now corrupted, because martyrs now might kill you in some schools. Whereas historically martyrs have never been people who threaten you, but people who are willing to lay down their life. And the early Christians did that time and time again. Men, women and children died in various terrible ways as the Romans tried to bring this ridiculous religion to an end that they saw as all sorts of threats. So people get this infection, and it infects the way they live, and the infection spreads. So we looked over the last couple of weeks at this woman, this wonderfully feisty woman. I think she's great. She comes to draw water from a well. And as you saw there in verse 29, she ends up leaving her jar of water. She doesn't get a drink for herself. She doesn't actually get a drink for Jesus. She comes thirsty. He comes thirsty. He ends up semi-satisfied. He talks to her about water. She thinks he's talking about the water in the well. He explains, no, I want to give you the water that satisfies the soul, that which you don't have, which you've been trying to find in other places. In the end, she gets so excited about him, she leaves the jar and heads back to town and talks. What has happened to her? Well, you get a bit of an inkling of it in what she says when she goes back to the town, where there's no doubt at all she would have been some sort of an outcast as a woman who was living with someone who wasn't her husband. In the way it would have even been in Australia, perhaps 100 years ago in many suburbs, but certainly in Samaria in the first century, to live with a man you're not married to, makes you a social outcast for certain. She goes back and in verse 29 she says to her neighbours, come and see a man who told me all the things I've ever done. Is this not the Christ? Or is this not the Christ, is it? And they went out of the city and were coming to him. So she goes back somewhat excited about Jesus. Two things she notes about him. One is his knowledge of her, which would have been very unsettling. Not just the fact that she says you've had five husbands, and we don't know what that means. Does that mean she's been a bit loose? Some people think so. I don't personally. We don't know. It's much more likely she's been taken up and dropped and taken up and dropped and taken up and dropped five times. So she's more probably hurt than she is amoral. But she's certainly made a decision now to live in a way quite contrary to what God has said, that she's living with a guy she's not married to. That would have been alarming with a stranger. But he said enough things that have really intrigued her and given her some hunch, maybe this is the long-awaited Messiah, which the Samaritans are waiting for, but with a little less knowledge. It is, to go back to Victor Hugo, she experiences something of the love of Jesus, even as she's being uncovered, and the things she would be ashamed of are being brought out to the open. Well, Victor Hugo said, saw the lucky signs around Sydney for Les Miserables so you're lucky to have that either here or coming. But the writer of that original story says this, that the greatest secret for human happiness is to know that we are loved for who we are, rather to know that we are loved in spite of who we are. Right? That's a great insight, I think, by the great writer. The great thing that the human heart needs to know is that we are loved in spite of who we are, that there's someone who knows you completely but loves you deeply. And will not be shocked, will not go, ooh, I didn't know that was true about you, but knows our wickedness much more than we do ourselves. That's what she's had. She's been exposed, but all the way through she's been loved and cared for by Jesus. So she rushes back. What do infected people do according to the Gospels? Well, let's have a look at this woman. She leaves her water pot, verse 28, went back to the city, which is an overstatement, it's a township really, and said to the men, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ? So instantly, without being commanded by Jesus, He doesn't say, look, I've just spent time talking to you. Men don't talk to women. Jews don't talk to Samaritans. Rabbis never talk to adulterous women. I've been very nice to you. Why don't you go back and tell your friends what a jolly fine chap I am? She just can't help herself. She cannot help herself. She's so amazed by what she's experienced with this strange Jewish man that she rushes back and she says, come and see. Come and see this guy. Christians have for some time described when they do that with workmates or family mates and irritate people sometimes, they say, I'm not saying I'm better than you. I'm just one beggar sharing with another beggar where we found food. And it's as simple as that. We're not saying, come and see me in my new spiritual devotions. Come and join me at my ashram. See if you can meditate as long as I can. I found a secret of peace. We're saying, come and see him. That's what the statement is. And that's what she does. There's a wonderful story in the Old Testament, hidden away in the book of 2 Kings, where this great city has been surrounded by the Amalekites, I think it was. And there's a couple of beggars who have to live outside the city anyhow. People in the city are dying from starvation. People in the city are eating their children, which is unthinkable, but when you're starving to death, you do unthinkable things. And these lepers are outside, and they have this discussion. You can read this in 2 Kings chapter 7. And the lepers say, look, we're going to starve to death here. Why don't we go and ask the besieging army if they might at least throw us a scrap of food, because they've got food, the city hasn't. So they say, we're going to die either way. So off they go, and they get there, and they discover that the whole army camp is empty. That God has done this stuff that has frightened them, and all the tents are just empty. The guys have just fled in a hurry because this noise came that the bad guys thought was the Egyptians and the Babylonians, some huge composition of bad guys, and they fled, and all their tents are there full of wealth and bread and meat and water, and they start to, as you would if you were starving, and I imagine lepers often didn't get to eat food like that, and then one of the guys said, hang on, what we're doing here is not good. This is a day of glad tidings. Woe to us if we don't go and tell the city. So they did. They went back. And it's a beautiful statement. They're eating because they've been deprived even before the army came. And then they go, no, this is what we're doing is wrong. This is a day of glad tidings. And I think what the woman's got here is exactly the same. When you discover something rich and valuable and there's ample of it, you can't help but say, this is a day of glad tidings. I don't mean to annoy you, but come and have a look at this. So that's what infected people do, and that's what they've done again and again and again. And my ancestors, we don't know who brought the Christian message to my ancestors. We do know that we killed hundreds of them as these little nobodies, really, mostly monks. And they tried to bring the message of Jesus to the Celts. And we said, thank you so much, and we killed them. And killed them and killed them and killed them, but they just kept coming. And eventually they built little churches and began to do the Lord's Supper and other stuff. And over hundreds of years, and after rivers of blood, in the end the Celtic people became overwhelmingly Christian. And why did the monks do that? It wasn't that the Pope back in Rome was saying, get out there, you scoundrels, and tell those dirty, filthy Celts. You just got something so wonderful, so true, so important, that's what happens. When you've got a good, clean dose of this infection, you end up doing what the woman did. And you go and say, come and have a look at this guy. Jesus then has a conversation with the disciples. It's helpful. If ever you find Jesus confusing and puzzling, you're in really good company. In fact, if you don't find Jesus puzzling and confusing, you probably haven't heard it. Because he is puzzling in a good way. But Nicodemus, back in chapter 3, who's a very fine man, an educated man, a scholar in the scriptures, he finds Jesus completely bamboozling. The woman finds Jesus very puzzling at first, but in the end sort of gets what he's on about. And the disciples come back and they're confused. Because they have this conversation with Jesus, as you can see in the middle paragraph there, verse 31. The disciples come back and they say that they went off to the local McDonald's to get some food for Jesus. Rabbi, eat, verse 32. He said, I have food to eat that you do not know about. So the disciples are saying to one another, no one brought him anything else to eat, did they? They just, what's going on? But Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. So Jesus says, you know what really keeps me going? You know what really energizes me? You know what excites me? It's doing the will of the one who sent me. It's fulfilling his purpose. And that's what he's doing. Elsewhere, Jesus says, I came to seek and save lost people, like this woman, like Nicodemus, who's lost in his goodness and his education, like me, like you. He comes to seek lost people, Jesus says, and that's what he's been doing. And he says, that's what energizes me. But I've got to do it until the work is finished. And this whole business of seeking and saving lost people, Jesus talks about this work. He pictures himself like a tradesman who's been set with a job, you know, repair the downpipe, you know, on the northeastern corner, replace the toilet. Okay, he's got all these things to do in the house. And he said, I've got a job to do. And in the end, he hasn't finished the job until he gets nailed up. And his last words, as you know, in John's Gospel is, Tetelestai, it is finished. So he says, I've got to do this work. I'm eager to do the work. The work is seeking and saving the lost. It's only when he dies that he says, done. Now I can relax. So Jesus pictures himself as out there doing a job. And then he begins to talk about the work in terms of farm imagery. Verse 35. Do you not say there are yet 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields. They are white for harvest. And on he goes to speak about the harvest and some details about it. Now, it's interesting when Jesus, he goes, what's his work? It's harvesting. That's what he was doing with the woman. He was harvesting her. Harvesting, as he says a couple of verses later, harvesting for eternal life, which is what he was offering this lady and gave to this lady, which is this relation, this being back in contact with the God who made us. And it's interesting because he says the fields are white for harvest. Why is that interesting? It's not very interesting. Unless you ask the question, what crop in the Middle East, around that part of the world, was white when it was ready for harvest? Well, as far as the historians and that can tell us, none of them. Most of them were in a very distinctive goldy, light browny colour when they were ripe and ready. So what's he talking about? The fields are white and ready for harvest. Well, there's a chap who has written a book on the geography of Palestine. His name, I've got it here somewhere. I could make it up, couldn't I? I think it's M.V. Morton. Yeah, so H.V. Morton wrote a book on the geography of Palestine. And he speaks about a time when he sat on this very well where Jesus was sitting. Well, the one we're pretty certain it is. It's been there for a couple of thousand years. And he said, suddenly I saw in the haze this whiteness coming towards me. And he said, and it was a group of the local Arabs, probably Samaritans, who often wear white. And he said, I suddenly realized what Jesus was saying when he made this weird comment about the fields are white and ready for harvest. Because the verses in verse 30, it just, when the woman goes and says, verse 30, they went out of the city and they were coming to him. So John's just said, over here, they're coming to Jesus. Back here at the well, Jesus is saying, I've got work to do, more important than eating, keeps me going. He says, lift up your eyes, he says, the fields are white and ready for harvest. And the white is, I don't think there's any reason, it's the Samaritans who are coming to Jesus. Not just one woman, but now the whole flipping village of these dirty, filthy people who the Jews hated and despised. They wouldn't mind them hearing good news, but they wouldn't have been ready for it. They would have needed some preparation before these good Jewish boys would ever think that these dirty Samaritan boys should hear the good news of Jesus. So that Jesus, he says, I'm on about harvest, and so his apprentices should be as well. And to bring this good news to people. And he says, look, don't say people aren't ready to hear. Don't say yet 4 months till the harvest. He says, the harvest is ripe. He said, you know, if you'd set up a committee saying, I wonder, should we, if the disciples have set up a little subcommittee, you know, Bartholomew, you can head this committee, get back to us a report in 3 years, the synod back then. And they would have said, look, these are needy people, but they're not ready. And we don't have the personnel yet. So let's leave them for a while and do other things. And Jesus saying, no, they're right and they're ready to go. And I had a man speak here last year, Mark Wormel, who was a partner at Allen's Arthur and whatever it is. And I remember when we had a big debate at the town hall between a Christian and atheist a million years ago. Mark said, look, he said, my friends at work are so burnt, they're so dried out and so, life has just worn them out. And they're so cynical, he said. He wasn't being harsh. He said, they won't come to any about Christianity. But he said, I'm going to ask them. Anyhow, as I may have shared with you before, in the town hall he had an entire row of his workmates. Mark tells the story, you know, to send himself up. He said, I'd worked with these people for years. I kind of thought I knew them. And he said, and I thought they were not ready for anything, even as something as light as a debate between a heavyweight atheist and a heavyweight Christian thinker. But to his surprise, when he asked them, they came. There's often a lot more life in people and interest than we ever let know. I sat at drinking tequila once with my niece. I didn't have much. It's horrible stuff. And there's a whole lot of weird things. I've never been in a late night bar in some crazy cow city in Canada before. But it was interesting because there's my niece with her best friend, absolutely best buddy. And somehow or other, they, after they'd had a few tequilas, they began to talk about God. I think it was because I was there and I'm a minister. And the intriguing thing was this, was that Sylvia's friend was very religious. Like, she often prayed to Mary and things like this, and she was saying, well, I often get my prayers answered, and I'm praying to Mary. But it was, and the interesting thing was that Sylvia was completely shocked that this girl had this religious thing happening, because in our culture, in Canada and Australia, not dissimilar in this, we don't talk about religion. We think, we fear, we long, and Jesus says, don't say people aren't ready. The fields are white and ready to go. And the Samaritan epidemic begins. The interesting thing with this epidemic, as it goes from one woman in the end to the whole city, is that they don't see any miracles. Because one of Jesus' frustrations in the Gospels is that you only believe when you see miracles. The Samaritans, and as I've tried to explain in the last few weeks, it's hard for us to understand the level of hatred and looking down the nose that your ordinary Jew had for their neighbours, the Samaritans. It was shared. Samaritans don't get any of that. Verse 39, from that city many of the Samaritans believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified. He told me all the things I've ever done. So when the Samaritans came to Jesus, they were asking him to stay with them. And he stayed with them for 2 days. And many more believed because of his word. And they were saying to the woman, I think this is a bit harsh, they were saying to the woman, it's no longer because of what you said that we believe. For we've heard for ourselves and know that this one is indeed the Saviour of the world. The highest statement of praise given to Jesus at this stage in the Gospels by any human being. But the interesting thing with these guys is they don't see any miracles, they just hear him. They say, hang on, can you stay for a couple of days with us? They put down their tools and they just sit and talk with him. There's no indication he does any works of power, but just to sit and listen to Jesus. As later on when those who go to arrest him say, no man ever spoke like this man. For people to have a chance just to hear what Jesus says seems to be enough to blow them out of the water, as it was for these Samaritans. Now my computer's blowing me out of the water. Mm-hmm. You're right, Ken, I should never have got an apple. Well, let me finish. This Christian infection continues on. Individual people get infected, they meet Jesus, and they go out and get others. Sometimes people are sent by groups of Christians. You may know that Korea now is the number of Christians, and this is particularly amongst the educated in Korea and the city dwellers, is increasing at 4 times the rate of the population. They're sending missionaries to Australia. I've met some. But how did Christianity get there? In 1866, a group of American adventurers thought that they would sail up this river to one of the main cities. Korea had already said we'd kill any white devils who come, because they knew what we were like, and they had rightly said no more. But this one of the guys who got on the boat, who was sort of unpopular, was a guy called Robert J. Thomas. Robert Thomas was a missionary in China, and he discovered that the educated, the learned leaders of Korea could all speak Chinese. So he wanted to go on this boat with a whole bunch of Bibles. Now, I won't bore you with the exciting story of how they got attacked by Koreans up and down the river, and eventually they got their boat stuck on rapids, and the Koreans sent out all these things with fire on them, and the boat got on fire. In the end, all the American adventurers got off, swords out, guns out, to go to the shore. They were all beaten to death. 30 years later, Sam Moffat also arrived, a Presbyterian, and he met some people, and he met some of them who had Bibles, and they were told this story, that Robert J. Thomas got off, and the man who met Moffat said, I just met this very weird man, because everyone else has got swords and guns and is fighting to the death. This man had arms full of books, and he was throwing them at people. He thought at first it was some sort of star knife, but he realized that this was just, and then as men came close to him, he would be holding out the, so as they were clubbing him, he'd be giving them the books. And one of them actually used the book for wallpaper in his house, and his neighbors would come and read. And when Moffat got there years later, there were two sorts of people. Those who were very impressed by this one peculiar man, who even at the point of death was saying, I want you to have this. And then others who read what he'd used as wallpaper and had actually become, as far as they can tell, Christian. It's that sort of infection that goes on and on. So the Samaritans have a great big epidemic, and for us still it's the same. There was something when... Did you get your $50? Did people work out what the three words were? If you got the email, there was an offer. We got one written application. What was that one? The three words? The three key words? But they were a good guess. They were a good guess. No shame in coming second. The three words... You're so nice, you don't want to take the $50 from me, do you? We're so overpaid in Canberra. All your taxes come to us, suckers. And we have roads and, you know, fantastic city. Okay. The three key words are what the woman says. It's what Nathaniel says earlier. It's actually the second thing Jesus says in the Gospel. Come and see. Come and see. And that's the magic that Christians have been saying for years. Come and see this guy. Come and have a look at him. There is no one like him. There's no one who will love you like him, who knows you like that. Or to use the words from the very beginning of the Gospel, we've seen his glory full of grace and truth. The truth about you, faith, the truth about God, revealed, and grace, the loving kindness of God to the undeserving. That's what we find in Jesus. And Christians have been forever saying, come and have a look. And so the thing has grown. It sometimes looks as if it's about to die. Right? Never does. It grows and grows. And I've got some statistics here about Africa and China, but they may come up in the question. I'll stop there so we've got some time. Yeah. They were sort of quarter Jews. That they were conquered. The great masses of them were taken away into slavery by the Assyrians. And then they transplanted other people in, which is what the Assyrians did. They'd move people around so people didn't have healthy, strong allegiances to their land. And that their religion was a mishmash of the worship of Israel, Yahweh, and also four or five other heathen gods. So the Jews hated them in the way that you often hate those who are closest to you. You know, they say civil wars are always the worst. So they were kind of... They saw themselves as Jews, but the Jews didn't see them as Jews. Any other questions?
We've got two in front of you.
Why does Christianity seem to be blasé about climate change, a real threat to our survival, and instead focus teaching instead on topics like homosexuality? Good question. I need to be brief because it's not central to this. I think Christians are blasé about climate change in the same way as engineers are. That is, many of them might be. I've got family members who are engineers, and they all think climate change is nonsense. But it would be wrong of me to say all engineers think it's nonsense. Just the ones that I run into do. I have met some who don't, and I think it's the same with one of my friends that I've known for some years, Byron Smith, is involved in all sorts of protests, getting himself arrested at various times. So there are Christians involved in it. I think sometimes Christians are reluctant to get involved in something because parts of the Green Movement are quite overtly anti-Christian. And part of the... I know friends of mine who vote for the... When they try to vote, there's the stuff that the Greens stand for that they really agree with, but the Greens also have things that if you're Christian, you really have problems with. So I certainly, and quite a lot of my friends are very concerned about climate change. I'm concerned. I go from thinking it's one of the primary things we need to be engaged in looking after the world to being unsure again, which my friends who are absolutely sure it's right. So that's the whole plot, is to make people uncertain. And I think with homosexuality, I've been in churches for 40 years. I guess I've heard maybe three or four sermons that in any way could be said to be about homosexuality. And I preached one or two of them, and they weren't even majorly about homosexuality. So I think one of the problems for Christians is that we keep getting asked about it. And therefore, we comment, and then I got caught up in a discussion once, a public discussion, where this lady kept asking me about homosexuality, and then she said, "See, this is the problem. You people are obsessed with homosexuality." I said, "In all fairness," and I don't think she was being tricky, but I just think she hadn't actually noticed the dynamic. She kept asking me, so I didn't want to avoid the issue. But it's on the boil at the moment, not so much homosexuality, right or wrong, but the question of changing of the definition of marriage. Weren't there about 50 signpost predictions in the Old Testament to point to Jesus the Christ? I think this is referencing back to the John's thing. Yes, some very intelligent people I know find one of the most persuasive things to them that Jesus really is the Son of God is the number of predictions that there were about Jesus that come true. I think this one, the one that John talked about, is one of the most fascinating. 700 years before Jesus comes, a man from Galilee will be, of the increase of his government, there'll be no end, etc. It's fascinating enough that Jesus says that his kingdom is like a mustard seed, the smallest of the seeds, proverbially, and it becomes the biggest of the trees. Because again, how could he possibly know that? Some people say, "Oh, well, the disciples made it up." Fine. If you think the disciples are 200 years old and they made it up in 200 AD, it's still a ridiculous prediction. But there are those sorts of predictions that are in the Bible about Jesus that many people do find extraordinarily persuasive. You need to look at them to work out. Sorry, Ian. Last one. Sorry, Ian, I love statistics. You should apologise. What were the African Chinese stats? Okay. Sorry to leave these other questions out. See if I can find them. And I don't think there's any contesting of these statistics, because I know you can feed with them. In Africa, in 1900, there were 10 million African Christians. I had the percentages elsewhere, but I don't have them. I didn't put them into this talk. There were 10 million Christians. 100 years later, there were 360 million. It went from about 3 or 4% of the people of Africa up to something like 46%. And the argument of Professor Jenkins and others like him is that by 2025, there'll be 633 million. Because in all the stats about which religion is the biggest, etc., the one that overwhelmingly is growing through conversions is Christianity. Most of Islam's growth is through childbirth, which is what makes some people anxious unnecessarily, I think. So Africa has had an amazing increase from 10 million to 360 million, and the population in Africa has not increased by 3,600% or whatever. And in China, when Mao Zedong died, he was confident that he had eliminated religion. And in the 1970s, people were very concerned that he had, because the church had gone completely underground. I think there are about equal number of Catholics and Protestants in China. In 1949, there were 1 million Protestants. In 2010, there are 58 million, and roughly the same number of Catholics. And at the rate of the church growing, they've got churches in China now that are twice as big as Westminster Cathedral, and they're building more and more. The suggestion is that within 10 years there'll be 160 million, and almost certainly China will become the largest single Christian nation in the world, although it's technically atheist, and they have had some of the provinces still burn down churches occasionally. So China has gone nuts, and China is sending missionaries out. And the last thing I'm going to say is this: the Chinese church feels called by God they've got this back to Jerusalem thing that they say, in terms of all the stans in between China and Jerusalem, they say there's a toxic view that a lot of those cultures have about Europeans or Americans, but they don't have it about the Chinese. So they feel God is calling them to reach back into all the stans on the way. And this thing just won't die. And the reason is because people keep saying, "Look at him." And when people do look at him, they find, well, as Einstein says, this luminous Galilean.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.